This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Revolution, written by Ron Paul and read by Bob Craig.
Preface. Every election cycle, we are treated to candidates who promise us change, and 2008 has been no different. But in the American political lexicon, change always means more of the same. More government, more looting of Americans, more inflation, more police state measures, more unnecessary war, and more centralization of power. Real change would mean something like the opposite of those things. It might even involve following our Constitution, and that's the one option Americans are never permitted to hear. Today, we are living in a fantasy world. Our entitlement programs are insolvent. In a couple of decades, they will face a shortfall amounting to tens of trillions of dollars. Meanwhile, the housing bubble is bursting and our dollar is collapsing. We are borrowing billions from China every day in order to prop up a bloated overseas presence that weakens our national defense and stirs up hostility against us. And all our political class can come up with is more of the same. One columnist puts it like this: we are borrowing from Europe in order to defend Europe. We are borrowing from Japan in order to keep cheap oil flowing to Japan. And we are borrowing from Arab regimes in order to install democracy in Iraq. Is it really isolationism to find something wrong with this picture? With national bankruptcy looming, politicians from both parties continue to make multi-trillion dollar promises of free goods from the government. And hardly a soul wonders if we can still afford to have troops in, and this is not a misprint, 130 countries around the world. All of this is going to come to an end sooner or later because financial reality is going to make itself felt in very uncomfortable ways. But instead of thinking about what this means for how we conduct our foreign and domestic affairs, our chattering classes seem incapable of speaking in anything but the emptiest platitudes, when they can be bothered to address serious issues at all. Fundamental questions like this, and countless others besides, are off the table in our mainstream media, which focuses our attention on trivialities and phony debates as we march toward oblivion. This is the deadening consensus that crosses party lines, that dominates our major media, and that is strangling the liberty and prosperity that were once the birthright of Americans. Dissenters who tell their fellow citizens what is really going on are subject to smear campaigns that, like clockwork, are aimed at the political heretic. Truth is treason in the empire of lies. There is an alternative to national bankruptcy, a bigger police state, trillion-dollar wars, and a government that draws ever more parasitically on the productive energies of the American people. It's called freedom. But as we've learned through hard experience, we are not going to hear a word in its favor if our political and media establishments have anything to say about it. If we want to live in a free society, we need to break free from these artificial limitations on free debate and start asking serious questions once again. I am happy that my campaign for the presidency has finally raised some of them, but this is a long-term project that will persist far into the future. These ideas cannot be allowed to die, buried beneath the mind-numbing chorus of empty slogans and inanities that constitute official political discourse in America. That is why I wrote this book. The Revolution. Chapter 1. The False Choices of American Politics. Every election season, America is presented with a series of false choices. Should we launch preemptive wars against this country or that one? Should every American neighborhood live under this social policy or that one? Should a third of our income be taken away by an income tax or a national sales tax? The shared assumptions behind these questions, on the other hand, are never cast in doubt or even raised. And anyone who wants to ask different questions or who suggests that the questions as framed exclude attractive, humane alternatives is ipso facto excluded from mainstream discussion. And so every 4 years, we are treated to the same tired, predictable routine. Two candidates, with few disagreements on fundamentals, pretend that they represent dramatically different philosophies of government. The supposedly conservative candidate tells us about waste in government and ticks off $10 million in frivolous pork barrel projects that outrage him, the inevitable Bridge to Nowhere project, or a study of the effects of celery consumption on arresting memory loss in order to elicit laughter and applause from partisan audiences. All right, so that's 0.00045% of the federal budget dealt with. What does he propose to do with the other 99.99955% in order to return our country to living within its means? Not a word. Those same three or four silly programs will be brought up all campaign long, and that's all we'll hear about where the candidate stands on spending. But conservatives are told that they must support these candidates, and so they do, hoping for the best, and nothing changes. Even war doesn't really distinguish the two parties from each other. Hillary Clinton and John Kerry voted for the Iraq War. With the exceptions of Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel, even the Democrats, who postured as anti-war candidates for the 2008 primary elections, are not especially opposed to needless wars. They typically have a laundry list of other military interventions they would support, none of which make any sense, would make our country any safer, or would do a thing to return our country to fiscal sanity. But liberals are told that they must support these candidates, and so they do, hoping for the best. And nothing changes. A substantial portion of the conservative movement has become a parody of its former self. Once home to distinguished intellectuals and men of letters, it now tolerates and even encourages anti-intellectualism and jingoism that would have embarrassed earlier generations of conservative thinkers. There are still some good and decent conservative leaders to be found, and a portion of the grassroots has remained uncorrupted by the transformation of conservatism into just another big government movement. But big government at home and abroad seems to suit many conservative spokesmen just fine. Once in a while, they will latch onto phony but conservative-sounding causes like tax reform, almost always a shell game in which taxes are shuffled around rather than actually reduced overall, in order to pacify the conservative base. But that's about it. When Republicans won a massive off-year election victory in 1994, neoconservative Bill Kristol immediately urged them not to do anything drastic, but to wait until the Republicans took the White House in 1996. Well, the Republicans didn't take the White House in 1996, so nothing ever got done. Instead, the Republican leadership urged these freshman congressmen to focus on a toothless, soporific agenda called the Contract with America that was boldly touted as a major overhaul of the federal government. Nothing could have been further from the truth. The Contract with America was typical of what I have just described. No fundamental questions are ever raised, and even supposedly radical and revolutionary measures turn out to be modest and the safe. In fact, the Brookings Institution in effect said if this is what conservatives consider revolutionary, then they have basically conceded defeat. Needless to say, I am also unimpressed by the liberal left. Although they posture as critical thinkers, their confidence in government is inexcusably naive, based as it is on civics textbook platitudes that bear absolutely zero resemblance to reality. Not even their position on unnecessary wars is consistent. Hillary Clinton and John Kerry both supported the Iraq War, for instance, and the major Democratic candidates in 2008 who claimed to be anti-war are generally eager to invade some other country apart from Iraq. Even Howard Dean was all in favor of Bill Clinton's intervention in Bosnia, going so far as to urge the president to take unilateral military action beyond the multilateral activity already taking place. Liberals at the grassroots, on the other hand, have been deeply alienated by the various betrayals by which a movement they once supported has made its peace with the establishment. No wonder frustrated Americans have begun referring to our two parties as the Republicrats. And no wonder the news networks would rather focus on $400 haircuts than matters of substance. There are no matters of substance. In late 2006, a number of friends and colleagues urged me to consider running for president. I was a reluctant candidate, not at all convinced that a sizable enough national constituency existed for a campaign based on liberty and the Constitution, rather than on special interest pandering and the distribution of loot. Was I ever wrong? On November 5, 2007, we set a record when we raised over $4 million online in a single day. That December 16th, on the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, we broke that record by raising over $6 million. In the fourth quarter of 2007, we raised more money than any other Republican candidate. Not only is the freedom message popular, but if fundraising ability is any indication, it is more intensely popular than any other political message. By the end of 2007, more than twice as many meetup groups had been formed in support of our campaign than for all the rest of the candidates in both major parties combined. I have never seen such a diverse coalition rallying to a single banner. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Greens, Constitutionalists, Whites, Blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, anti-war activists, homeschoolers, religious conservatives, free thinkers, all were not only involved, but enthusiastically so. And despite their philosophical differences in some areas, these folks typically found, to their surprise, that they rather liked each other. The mainstream media had no idea what to make of it, since we were breaking all the rules and yet still attracting such a varied and passionate following. I began making this a central point of my public speeches. The reason all these different groups are rallying to the same banner, I said, is that freedom has a unique power to unite us. In case that sounds like a cliche, it isn't. It's common sense. When we agree not to treat each other merely as means to our own selfish ends, but to respect one another as individuals with rights and goals of our own, cooperation and goodwill suddenly become possible for the first time. My message is one of freedom and individual rights. I believe individuals have a right to life and liberty, and that physical aggression should be used only defensively. We should respect each other as rational beings by trying to achieve our goals through reason and persuasion rather than threats and coercion. That, and not a desire for economic efficiency, is the primary moral reason for opposing government intrusions into our lives. Government is force, not reason. People seem to think I am speaking of principles foreign to the Republican tradition. But listen to the words of Robert A. Taft, who in the old days of the Republican Party was once its standard bearer. When I say liberty, I do not simply mean what is referred to as free enterprise. I mean liberty of the individual to think his own thoughts and live his own life as he desires to think and to live. The liberty of the family to decide how they wish to live, what they want to eat for breakfast and for dinner, and how they wish to spend their time. Liberty of a man to develop his ideas and get other people to teach those ideas, if he can convince them that they have some value to the world. Liberty of every local community to decide how its children shall be educated, how its local services shall be run, and who its local leaders shall be. Liberty of a man to choose his own occupation, and liberty of a man to run his own business as he thinks it ought to be run, as long as he does not interfere with the right of other people to do the same thing. As we'll see in a later chapter, Taft was also an opponent of needless wars and of unconstitutional presidential war-making. This is the Republican tradition to which I belong. Early on in my presidential campaign, people began describing my message and agenda as a revolution. In a way, it is, albeit a peaceful one. In a country with a political debate as restricted as ours, it is revolutionary to ask whether we need troops in 130 countries, and whether the non-interventionist foreign policy recommended by our founding fathers might not be better. It is revolutionary to ask whether the accumulation of more and more power in Washington has been good for us. It is revolutionary to ask fundamental questions about privacy, police state measures, taxation, social policy, and countless other matters. This revolution, though, is not altogether new. It is a peaceful continuation of the American Revolution and the principles of our founding fathers: liberty, self-government, the Constitution, and a non-interventionist foreign policy. That is what they taught us, and that is what we now defend. I was never interested in writing a campaign book, as they tend to have deservedly short shelf lives. But the ideas I have been promoting, and which have struck such a powerful chord with so many Americans, are ideas that are overlooked and neglected because they do not fit into the template of trivial questions with which I open this chapter. This book is an opportunity to highlight and explain them in a kind of systematic fashion that campaign speeches and presidential debates simply do not allow. The revolution my supporters refer to will persist long after my retirement from politics. Here is my effort to give them a long-term manifesto based on ideas and perhaps some short-term marching orders. At the same time, I am also describing what the agenda of George W. Bush's successor should be if we want to move toward a free society once again. Our country is facing an unprecedented financial crisis precisely because the questions our political and media establishments allow us to ask are so narrow. Whether or not politicians actually want to hear them, it has never been more important for us to begin posing significant and fundamental questions. In all affairs, Bertrand Russell once said, it's a healthy thing now and then to hang a question mark on the things you have long taken for granted. I'm not in the habit of quoting Russell, but when in American history has his sentiment been more true? Chapter 2. The Foreign Policy of the Founding Fathers. Our founding fathers gave us excellent advice on foreign policy. Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, called for peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. George Washington, several years earlier, took up this theme in his farewell address. Harmony, liberal intercourse with all nations, are recommended by policy, humanity, and interest, he maintained. But even our commercial policy should hold an equal and impartial hand. Neither seeking nor granting exclusive favors or preferences. Washington added, the great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. Why quit our own stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, or caprice? Unfortunately, we have spent the past century spurning this sensible advice. If the founders' advice is acknowledged at all, it is dismissed on the grounds that we no longer live in their times. The same hackneyed argument could be used against any of the other principles the founders gave us. Should we give up the First Amendment because times have changed? How about the rest of the Bill of Rights? It's hypocritical and childish to dismiss certain founding principles simply because a convenient rationale is needed to justify foolish policies today. The principles enshrined in the Constitution do not change. If anything, today's more complex world cries out for the moral clarity of a non-interventionist foreign policy. It is easy to dismiss the non-interventionist view as the quaint aspiration of men who lived in a less complicated world, but it's not so easy to demonstrate how our current policies serve any national interest at all. Perhaps an honest examination of the history of American interventionism in the 20th century, from Korea to Vietnam to Kosovo to the Middle East, would reveal that the founding fathers foresaw more than we think. Anyone who advocates the non-interventionist foreign policy of the founding fathers can expect to be derided as an isolationist. I myself have never been an isolationist. I favor the very opposite of isolation. Diplomacy, free trade, and freedom of travel. The real isolationists are those who impose sanctions and embargoes on countries and peoples across the globe because they disagree with the internal and foreign policies of their leaders. The real isolationists are those who choose to use force overseas to promote democracy rather than seek change through diplomacy, engagement, and by setting a positive example. The real isolationists are those who isolate their country in the court of world opinion by pursuing needless belligerence and war that have nothing to do with legitimate national security concerns. Interestingly enough, George W. Bush sounded some of these themes when he ran for president in the year 2000. By that time, many Republicans had grown weary of Bill Clinton's military interventions and forays into nation-building and wanted to put a stop to it. Sensibly enough, Bush spoke of a humble foreign policy, no nation-building, and no policing the world. In 1999, then-Governor Bush declared, "Let us have an American foreign policy that reflects American character, the modesty of true strength, the humility of real greatness." In a debate with Vice President Al Gore the following year, Bush said, "I'm not so sure the role of the United States is to go around the world and say, this is the way it's got to be. I think one way for us to end up being viewed as the ugly American is for us to go around the world saying, we do it this way, so should you." Bush also rejected nation building. "Somalia started off as a humanitarian mission and changed into a nation building mission," he said. "And that's where the mission went wrong. The mission was changed, and as a result, our nation paid a price. And so I don't think our troops ought to be used for what's called nation-building." He added, "I think what we need to do is convince the people who live in the lands themselves to build the nations." Maybe I'm missing something here. We're going to have a kind of a nation-building corps from America? Finally, when discussing other countries' perception of the United States, Bush said, "If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. If we're a humble nation, but strong, they'll welcome us." Our nation stands alone right now in the world in terms of power, and that's why we've got to be humble. We should be proud and confident in our values, but humble in how we treat nations that are figuring out how to chart their own course. In other words, President Bush ran and won on a very different foreign policy from the one we are told all Republicans must support. We know what came later, of course, and by the 2008 Republican primaries, one of the frontrunners had strayed so far from President Bush's original platform that he was even saying that in the future, nation-building should become one of the standard functions of the American military. Some Americans may be familiar with the admonition of John Quincy Adams that America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. But his sentiments extended well beyond this oft-cited maxim. First, Adams considered what could be said in America's defense if anyone were ever to wonder what she had done for the world. If the wise and learned philosophers of the elder world should find their hearts disposed to inquire what has America done for the benefit of mankind, let our answer be this. America, with the same voice which spoke herself into existence as a nation, proclaimed to mankind the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the only lawful foundation of government. America, in the assembly of nations, since her admission among them, has invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. She has uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often to disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, of equal justice, and of equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly a half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when the conflict has been for principles to which she clings as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. Adams then described the foreign policy of the American Republic. "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. This was an isolationism. It was a beautiful and elegant statement of common sense and of principles that at one time were taken for granted by nearly everyone. In the same way, Henry Clay was merely repeating George Washington's wise sentiments rather than giving voice to isolationism when he urged this piece of advice upon his countrymen. By the policy to which we have adhered since the days of Washington, we have done more for the cause of liberty than arms could effect. We have shown to other nations the way to greatness and happiness. Far better is it for ourselves and the cause of liberty that adhering to our Pacific system and avoiding the distant wars of Europe, we should keep our lamp burning brightly on the western shore as a light to all nations than to hazard its utter extinction amid the ruins of fallen and falling republics in Europe. Thus, we should strive to lead by example rather than force, and provide a model for the world that other peoples will wish to follow. We do no one any good by bankrupting ourselves. Richard Cobden was a 19th-century British statesman who opposed all of his government's foreign interventions. In those days, though, people understood the philosophy of non-intervention much better than they do today, and no one was silly enough to brand Cobden an isolationist. He was known instead, appropriately enough, as the international man. There are those who condemn non-interventionists for being insufficiently ambitious, for their unwillingness to embrace national greatness, as if a nation's greatness could be measured according to any calculus other than the virtues of its people and the excellence of its institutions. These critics should have the honesty to condemn the founding fathers for the same defect. They wouldn't dare, but it would be refreshing to hear it stated in so many words. Our current political class is blessed with historic genius, and Jefferson, Washington, and Madison were contemptible fools. What the founding fathers have to teach us about foreign policy became all the more important, and yet all the more ignored, in the wake of the horrific attacks of September the 11th, 2001. In the weeks that follow that fateful day, most Americans' focus was on identifying the sponsors of the attacks and punishing them. That was sensible enough. I myself voted to track down Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but people were bound to start wondering eventually why we were attacked, not because they sought to excuse the attackers, of course, but out of a natural curiosity regarding what made these men tick. Looking for motive is not the same thing as making excuses. Detectives always look for the motive behind crime, but no one thinks they are looking to excuse murder. 7 years later, though, our political class still refuses to deal with the issue in anything but sound bites and propaganda. The rest of the world is astonished at this refusal to speak frankly about the reality of our situation, and yet our safety and security may depend on it. One person to consult if we want to understand those who wish us harm is Michael Schauer, who was chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit at the Counter-Terrorist Center in the late 1990s. Schauer is a conservative and a pro-life voter who has never voted for a Democrat, and he refuses to buy the usual line that the attacks on America have nothing to do with what our government does in the Islamic world. In fact, he says, those attacks have everything to do with what we do. Some people simply will not listen to this kind of argument or will pretend to misunderstand it, trivializing this profoundly significant issue by alleging that Schauer is blaming America for the attacks. To the contrary, Schauer could not be any clearer in his writing that the perpetrators of terrorist attacks on Americans should be pursued mercilessly for their acts of barbarism. His point is very simple. It is unreasonable, even utopian, not to expect people to grow resentful and desirous of revenge when your government bombs them, supports police states in their countries, and imposes murderous sanctions on them. That revenge, in its various forms, is what our CIA calls blowback, the unintended consequences of military intervention. Obviously, the onus of blame rests with those who perpetrate acts of terror, regardless of their motivation. The question Schauer and I are asking is not who is morally responsible for terrorism. Only a fool would place the moral responsibility for terrorism on any one other than the terrorists themselves. The question we are asking is less doltish and more serious. Given that a hyper-interventionist foreign policy is very likely to lead to this kind of blowback, are we still sure we want such a foreign policy? Is it really worth it to us? The main focus of our criticism, in other words, is that our government's foreign policy has put the American people in greater danger and made us more vulnerable to attack than we would otherwise have been. This is the issue that we and others want to raise before the American people. The interventionist policies that have given rise to blowback have been bipartisan in their implementation. For instance, it was Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who said on 60 Minutes that 500,000 dead Iraqi children as a result of the sanctions on that country during the 1990s were worth it. Who could be so utopian, so detached from reality, as to think a remark like that, which was broadcast all over the Arab world, you can be sure, and policies like these would not provoke a response? If Americans lost that many of their family members, friends, and fellow citizens, would they not seek to hunt down the perpetrators and be unsatisfied until they were apprehended? The question answers itself. So why wouldn't we expect people to try to take revenge for these policies? I have never received an answer to this simple and obvious question. This does not mean Americans are bad people, or that they are to blame for terrorism, strawman arguments that supporters of intervention raise in order to cloud the issue and demonize their opponents. It means only that actions cause reactions, and that Americans will need to prepare themselves for these reactions if their government is going to continue to intervene around the world. In the year 2000, I wrote, "The cost in terms of liberties lost and the unnecessary exposure to terrorism are difficult to determine. But in time, it will become apparent to all of us that foreign interventionism is of no benefit to American citizens, but instead is a threat to our liberties. I stand by every word of that." To those who say that the attackers are motivated by a hatred of Western liberalism or the moral degeneracy of American culture, Schauer points out that Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini tried in vain for a decade to instigate an anti-Western jihad on exactly that basis. It went nowhere. Bin Laden's message, on the other hand, has been so attractive to so many people because it is fundamentally defensive. Bin Laden, says Schauer, has spurned the Ayatollah's wholesale condemnation of Western society, focusing instead on specific bread-and-butter issues on which there is widespread agreement among Muslims. What bin Laden's sympathizers object to, as they have said again and again, is our government's propping up of an unpopular regimes in the Middle East, the presence of American troops on the Arabian Peninsula, the American government's support for the activities of governments like Russia that are hostile to the Muslim populations, and what they believe to be an American bias toward Israel. The point is not that we need to agree with these arguments, but that we need to be aware of them if we want to understand what is motivating so many people to rally to bin Laden's banner. Few people are moved to leave behind their worldly possessions and their families to carry out violence on behalf of a disembodied ideology. It is practical grievances, perhaps combined with an underlying ideology, that motivate large numbers to action. At a press conference I held at the National Press Club in May 2007, Schauer told reporters about the only thing that can hold together the very loose coalition that Osama bin Laden has assembled is a common Muslim hatred for the impact of U.S. foreign policy. They all agree they hate U.S. foreign policy. To the degree we change that policy in the interest of the United States, they become more and more focused on their local problems. That's not what a lot of our talking heads tell us on television every day, but few people are in a better position to understand bin Laden's message than Schauer, one of our country's foremost experts on the man. Philip Giraldi, another conservative and former counter-terrorist expert with the CIA, adds that anybody who knows anything about what's been going on for the last 10 years would realize that cause and effect are operating here, that essentially Al-Qaeda has an agenda which very specifically says what its grievances are. And its grievances are basically that we're over there. The simple fact is that there are consequences for our presence in the Middle East, and if we seriously want to address the terrorism problem, we have to be serious about that issue. Even Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz recognized that foreign intervention could have unintended consequences and that the American presence in the Middle East had bred hostility against our country. On May 29, 2003, Reuters reported, Wolfowitz said another reason for the invasion of Iraq had been almost unnoticed but huge, namely that the ousting of Saddam would allow the United States to remove its troops from Saudi Arabia, where their presence had long been a major Al-Qaeda grievance. In short, according to Wolfowitz, one of the motivations of the 9/11 attackers was resentment over the presence of American troops on the Arabian Peninsula. Again, neither Wolfowitz nor I have ever said or believed that Americans had it coming on 9/11, or that the attacks were justified, or any of this other nonsense. The point is a simple one. When our government meddles around the world, it can stir up hornets' nests and thereby jeopardize the safety of the American people. That's just common sense. But hardly anyone in our government dares to level with the American people about our fiasco of a foreign policy. Blowback should not be a difficult or surprising concept for conservatives and libertarians, since they often emphasize the unintended consequences that even the most well-intentioned domestic program can have. We can only imagine how much greater and unpredictable the consequences of intervention abroad might be. A classic example of blowback involves the overthrow of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. American and British intelligence collaborated on the overthrow of Mossadegh's popularly elected government, replacing him with a politically reliable but repressive Shah. Years later, a revolutionary Iranian government took American citizens hostage for 444 days. There is a connection here. Not because supporters of radical Islam would have had much use for the secular Mossadegh, but because on a human level, people resent that kind of interference in their affairs. When it comes to suicide bombing, I, like many others, always assumed that the driving force behind the practice was Islamic fundamentalism. Promise of instant entry into paradise as a reward for killing infidels was said to explain the suicides. The world's expert on suicide terrorism convinced me to rethink this apparently plausible answer. The University of Chicago's Robert Pape, for his book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, collected a database of all 462 suicide terrorist attacks between 1980 and 2004. One thing he found was that religious beliefs were less important as motivating factors than we have believed. The world's leaders in suicide terrorism are actually the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, a Marxist secular group. The largest Islamic fundamentalist countries have not been responsible for any suicide terrorist attacks. Not one has come from Iran or the Sudan. The clincher is this. The strongest motivation, according to Pape, is not religion, but rather a desire to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from the territory the terrorists view as their homeland. Between 1995 and 2004, the Al-Qaeda years, two-thirds of all attacks came from countries where the United States had troops stationed. While Al-Qaeda terrorists are twice as likely to hail from a country with a strong Wahhabist radical Islamic presence, they are 10 times as likely to come from a country in which U.S. troops are stationed. Until the U.S. invasion in 2003, Iraq had never had a suicide terrorist attack in its entire history. Between 1982 and 1986, there were 41 suicide terrorist attacks in Lebanon. Once the U.S., France, and Israel withdrew their forces from Lebanon, there were no more attacks. The reason the attacks stopped, according to Pape, is that the Osama bin Ladens of the world can no longer inspire potential suicide terrorists, regardless of their religious beliefs. Pape is convinced, after his extensive research, that the longer and more extensive the occupation of Muslim territories, the greater the chance of more 9/11-type attacks on the United States. Although most Americans don't know it, for much of the early 20th century our country had an excellent reputation in the Middle East, the part of the world we are now told will hate us no matter what we do. Right now, after decades of meddling, our government is hated in the Middle East and around the world to a degree I have never before seen in my lifetime. That does not make us safer. To be sure, there will always be those who wish us ill, regardless of the foreign policy we adopt. But those who would recruit large numbers of their co-religionists to carry out violence against Americans find their task very difficult when they cannot point to some tangible issue that will motivate people to do so. It is bin Laden's specific list of grievances that has rallied so many to his cause. Predictably enough, Al-Qaeda recruitment has exploded since the invasion of Iraq. The war in Iraq was one of the most ill-considered, poorly planned, and just plain unnecessary military conflicts in American history, and I opposed it from the beginning. But the beginning I am speaking of was not 2002 or 2003. As early as 1997 and 1998, shortly after my return to Congress, after a dozen years back in my medical practice, I spoke out against the actions of the Clinton administration, which I believed was moving us once again toward war with Iraq. I believe the genesis of our later policy was being set at that time. Many of the same voices who then demanded that the Clinton administration attack Iraq later demanded that the Bush administration attack Iraq, exploiting the tragedy of September 11th to bring about their long-standing desire to see an American invasion of that country. Any rationale would do. Weapons of mass destruction, the wickedness of Saddam, an issue that did not seem to keep many of these policymakers up at night in the 1980s when they were supporting him. A Saddam, Al-Qaeda link, whatever. As long as their Middle Eastern ambitions could be satisfied, it did not matter how the people were brought along. By any standard, constitutional, financial, national defense, I could not see the merits of the proposed invasion of Iraq. Any serious Middle East observer could have told us, if we were listening, that Iraq had essentially no connection to terrorism. At the time of the Persian Gulf War of 1991, Osama bin Laden actually offered to lead an army to defend Saudi Arabia against Saddam if necessary. Iraq had not attacked us, and figures in our own government, including Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, had said that Saddam was effectively contained and no threat to anyone. Saddam's was not even an Islamic regime. It was a secular one, although thanks to the war, that is now changing. Some war apologists to this day still try to argue that the weapons were really there or that Saddam really was linked to Al-Qaeda, but I'm not sure why they bother. The administration long ago gave up these claims. In the midst of all this, it is essential not to lose sight of the moral dimension of war and the lengths to which Christian and later secular thinkers have gone over the centuries to limit and restrict the waging of war. For well over 1,000 years, there has been a doctrine and the Christian definition of what constitutes a just war. This just war tradition developed in the 4th century with Ambrose and Augustine, but grew to maturity with Thomas Aquinas and such late scholastics as Francisco Vidatoria and Francisco Suarez. The requirements for a just war vary to some extent from commentator to commentator, but those who wrote on the subject shared some basic principles. The war in Iraq did not even come close to satisfying them. First, there has to be an initial act of aggression in response to which a just war may be waged. But there was no act of aggression against the United States. We are 6,000 miles from Iraq. The phony stories we were told about unmanned drones coming to get us were, to say the least, not especially plausible. Second, diplomatic solutions had not been exhausted. They had hardly been tried. Traditional just war criteria also demand that the initiation of war be undertaken by the proper authority. Under the U.S. Constitution, the proper authority is neither the President nor the United Nations. It is Congress. But Congress unconstitutionally delegated its decision-making power over war to the President. I had heard it argued that Saddam had indeed committed an act of aggression against the United States. He had shot at our airplanes. Those American planes were monitoring the no-fly zones over Iraq. Authority for such zones was said to come from UN Resolution 688, which instructs nations to contribute to humanitarian relief in the Kurdish and Shiite areas. The resolution actually says nothing about no-fly zones, and nothing about bombing missions over Iraq. That Saddam Hussein missed every single airplane for 12 years as tens of thousands of sorties were being flown indicates the utter weakness of our enemy, an impoverished third world nation that lacked an air force, anti-aircraft weapons, and the navy. This was supposed to be the great threat, requiring urgent action. Such nonsense insults the intelligence of the American people and makes the rest of the world wonder about our sanity. And yet the propaganda continues even today. In one of the Republican presidential debates, after being called an isolationist, honestly, is the distinction between isolationism and non-interventionism really so difficult to grasp? I was solemnly informed that the course I recommended in Iraq amounted to the same kind of thinking that had led to Hitler. Now, all of us are used to hearing political propaganda, especially in presidential debates, but this really took the cake. Were the American people expected to believe that unless they supported the invasion and occupation of a completely paralyzed third world country, they were the sort of people who would have given aid and comfort to Hitler? Did this candidate really have such a low estimate of the intelligence of the American people? How, after all, had Hitler been able to rise to power in the first place? Hitler made a name for himself by denouncing the Treaty of Versailles, which established the peace terms with Germany at the end of World War I. Many observers at the time and since have described the treaty as severe and one-sided, and no, that is not how all post-war treaties are. After the Napoleonic Wars, the last continent-wide conflict until World War I, the Congress of Vienna imposed reasonable terms on defeated France and fully welcomed her back into the community of nations within only a few years. Hitler appealed directly to this sense of grievance on the part of the German people. How long, he asked, are we going to allow ourselves to be treated like a third-class nation? Now let us recall President Woodrow Wilson's decision to involve the United States in World War I. The level of popular support for Wilson's decision may perhaps be gauged by the massive propaganda campaign, without precedent in American history, that the government undertook to win over the public opinion. The war in Europe had been a stalemate prior to Wilson's intervention. Thanks to that intervention, not only did the Allies win, but they were also now in a position to impose the punitive Versailles Treaty on a defeated Germany. It is not at all a stretch to say, as many historians have indeed said, that Wilson's decision to intervene gave inadvertent impetus to Hitler's politics of extreme nationalism, since the treaty it made possible helped catapult him into the limelight. Hitler might otherwise have remained a nobody. German President Paul von Hindenburg was said to have sized him up as potentially a good postmaster general. Did Wilson intend this outcome? Did he intend to hand Hitler and his party a perfect strategy for their political advancement? Of course not. But here we are, faced once again with the unpredictability of foreign intervention and the strong possibility that by removing a bad government, we may wind up not with a better one, but a far worse one. Ever since then, no libertarian or traditional conservative I am aware of has had anything but contempt for the utopian Wilson. The mainstream left of his day was largely disillusioned by the outcome, having hoped for a more just peace and genuine progressives like Robert La Follette, Randolph Bourne, and Jane Addams had opposed the war from the beginning. That essentially leaves a smattering of neoconservatives today as Wilson's remaining defenders. But here was a historical lesson to learn, if there ever was one. The Iraq War is sometimes portrayed as a conservative-liberal issue. It isn't. Supporters of war and empire come from both political parties and can be found among both liberals and conservatives. The liberal media supported the Iraq War with enthusiasm, and their eagerness to parrot the official line abandoned whatever critical faculties they possessed. The American media were so derelict in their duty during the Iraq War that one watchdog group actually offered a $1,000 reward for any reporter who would ask the administration the challenging question about pre-war intelligence. Hillary Clinton was a strong supporter of the war. Following the off-year election in 2006, congressional Democrats, for the most part, revealed themselves once again to be a sorry excuse for an opposition party, continuing to fund the war and refusing to take any bold action. For much of 2006 and 2007, it looked as if we were in for a repeat performance. Propaganda and slogans parroted by the media threatened to take us to war yet again. Then things changed. In December 2007, a national intelligence estimate compiled by 16 agencies of the American intelligence apparatus concluded that Iran had discontinued its nuclear weapons program in 2003 and had not resumed it. Up until the very moment that report was issued, the so-called liberal media had been serving once again as uncritical mouthpieces of administration war propaganda, providing cover for yet another costly and avoidable conflict. This would never happen again, reporters and editorial writers assured us after the Iraq fiasco. 10 minutes later, they were back to their usual collusion with the political establishment. I had said all along that Iran posed no imminent nuclear threat to us or to her neighbors, and now the intelligence community had confirmed that view, a view anyone who read newspapers outside the United States would have been informed.